This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 279 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'll introduce a couple of co-hosts. I'd really like to introduce our guest first because we have such an exciting guest, but these guys will get mad at me if I leave them out, so...
Oh, no, go ahead. Introduce our guest first.
No, we'll start with you, David Vanderhoof, from the What Just Flew By blog.
Hey, Max. Yeah, I'm excited about our guest, too. He's definitely a friend of our show, and... looking forward to tonight, and it's also that time of the year where I have to frantically come up with a Christmas story, which I did, so stay tuned for that. No history segment, but definitely something different.
Okay, good. We'll look forward to that. We'll also look forward to hearing the usual brilliance from Rob Mark. He's with the Jetwine blog and actually many other things as well, aren't you, Rob?
Well, occasionally, and good evening to everybody from Chicago, where, let's see, I'm looking out the window. It's a nice, clear night. Appears to be about 74 here.
Yeah. Somehow I doubt that.
Wait a minute. You doubt that? Really 74?
No, not at all. I wish it was 74.
Well, actually, I was just testing out my, you know, I didn't spend 10 years as a controller for nothing. You know, we learn how to use words like appears so that in case something gets screwed up later, we can always say, well, that's the way it looked to me, even if it wasn't right. You know, if the guy landed with his gear up when you told him it was down, you would always say it appears down.
It appears down.
You're using the example of an aircraft landing with its gear up for just because our guest is on the show, Rob?
Well, I thought that would be a great safety item, you know, gear down and locked. Wouldn't that be a good show name? Gear down and locked.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, maybe not. Okay. Who's our guest anyway?
Our returning guest is Bill English. Bill is an investigator in charge with the NTSB Office of Aviation Safety. Now, Bill's been with the NTSB for quite a while, since 1999. And he's been the lead investigator on a number of significant aviation accidents, both in the U.S. and around the world, including the Continental Airlines 1404 accident in Denver. Also, remember this one, Rob, the 737 and Legacy that sort of tangled in midair in Brazil?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Also, UPS Flight 6.
That was Dubai.
Also, a U.S. Navy contracted Boeing 707 tanker. But most recently, and this is what we want to talk to Bill about this episode, the Asiana Flight 214 Boeing 777 in San Francisco. So, Bill, it's great to have you back on the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Great to be back, Max and Rob and David. I guess it makes me a repeat offender, but good to be back with y'all.
I can't believe you came back after the way we treated you last time, Bill.
Oh, well, you know, time heals.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing. And it is Christmas time, isn't it?
Right.
Well, that's good to know.
Bill, you're also a commercial rated pilot, I believe. And I don't think we haven't talked about that at all in the past, have we?
Well, I don't remember. But yes, that's right. Commercial rated pilot and flight instructor. And prior to the board, worked in some investigations and procedures development for the FAA. Flew some corporate and test and evaluation electronics jobs prior to that, and worked on IFR magazine, which I think some of you probably have heard of. And
yes,
worked all the way back to I think my very first flying job was a traffic reporter, flying rubberneck.
Wow! And you're an Embry-Riddle graduate too, aren't you?
Correct, like many of us here.
Fantastic. All right. Well, with Bill here, we want to get the most out of this opportunity. So we're going to focus first on the NTSB process for investigating aviation accidents. And then we're going to talk about last week's investigative hearing on the Asiana crash. So to that end, I think what we'll do is start with that. And then afterwards, we'll reverse things a little bit. If we have time, we'll maybe talk a little bit about the aviation news. But we really want to defer our time to Bill in that conversation. So we'll see how that goes. And then David mentioned he's got a special Christmas segment for our normal history segment. We also have an Australia desk report, of course, and an Across the Pond segment. And we have some listener mail. We are only going to be able to get to some of it, unfortunately, because we've really been receiving an awful lot of it. But we'll try to do as much of it as we can.
Well, you know, we could certainly save a lot of time if we just threw out all the bad stuff that we get. The nasty comments. We could just, you know, pretend we didn't even get them. And
but unfortunately, we don't get those kind of emails.
I know. I was just going to say that. That's pretty cool, actually.
Yeah. Well, we haven't had a... Actually, you know, that's kind of a good point. Constructive criticism, we always like. I mean, it's nice to hear that we're doing things well, but folks... This could be dangerous, Rob, huh? Folks have some suggestions or constructive criticisms. Hey, we'll take those too, so don't be shy.
Speak for yourself, Max. Yeah,
I know. I told you this could be dangerous.
It's been a long time since we got that email about that guy who said that jerk who tells bad jokes.
Yeah, I think I remember that. I was just a child.
All right, again, we're talking with Bill English from the NTSB. Bill, maybe you can take us through kind of the process. Just in general, when there's a major accident of some kind, what starts that off? What does the phone ring next to your bed at night and off you go? How does that work?
Well, sometimes, yes, it does work that way. So I thought we would do that. Let's walk through sort of that day in the life when a major accident really happens and the go team goes. It's something you think about maybe from a movie, but it's real. We have our go team that we put together, and I'll kind of walk you through what happens when a major event such as the Asiana 214 accident occurs. In this case, I was on call, and we keep an on-call rotation. So there's six of us major investigators based in Washington, and we do a rotation about 2 weeks on per person. And the team is made up of other specialist investigators that are also based in, usually in D.C., but some in different parts of the country. And for that week or two period, the team is built up. So I don't have any specific team that's with me every time. They change around depending on how things are going, workload. So there's that 10 or a dozen or so investigators that would make up a major go team.
So it's just kind of the luck of the draw for a particular accident.
Exactly. I might work with a systems specialist and an operations specialist on one accident, but then the people in that role on a different accident would be possibly different people. Although I do have to tell you, we don't have a whole lot of people in any of our roles. Six major investigators is actually pretty fat. As you might know, the board itself is only the whole staff is only about 390 people. That's for all our modes. So that's aviation, rail, highway, the laboratories, hazmat, all of that. That includes the general aviation folks that are scattered around the country. So there's only a handful of people in any one specialty that we have. So we build our team from that. We really do have those windbreakers with the big yellow NTSB on the back, just like the movies. And when we are on go team, when we're on call, we need to be available to launch, which means get to Washington National Airport and head to wherever it is we need to go within 2 hours. So we'll hear about an accident a number of different ways. There's a regulation, actually, that specifies how an operator is supposed to notify the NTSB of an accident. But in the case of a major event, we almost always hear about it through the media or from FAA because air traffic control has witnessed the event happen. So there's a very quick notification. And at a major airport like San Francisco, of course, air traffic saw the accident happen, and the media started coverage almost immediately. So the first things that happened to me on this one was my phone rang, and I was out and about. It was the weekend. And the phone rang, and it was my boss. I was actually out with one of our other investigators, and both our phones started ringing at the same time. And we looked at each other and said, this is not a good sign.
Yeah.
So that was the boss letting us know that there was a catastrophic event in San Francisco. Right then, when the balloon goes up, the information is very bad, as you can probably imagine. It's scattershot. It's a game of telephone. You never know what's accurate. All you know at that point is major event happened, and then the general outline. A 777 at San Francisco and a catastrophic event is pretty much all we knew at that moment, and then we have to start the ball rolling. So hop in the car and start headed for home to put the go bag together and start assembling the team right away while everyone else that's available kicks into gear as well. So in this case, as I mentioned, it was a nice summer July weekend day here in the D.C. area where I was. And so started heading home and started to put together my go bag for that. So this is the very special David inspired segment because I know he loves the go bag and anybody that has a go bag. So
now, be fair, if you have a go bag, if you have something that's packed and ready to go, you must be doing something important with your life.
So important or very dangerous. In our case, our go bag, and you got a good point there, packed and ready to go, but I don't know where I'm going to go. So there's a basic outline to what you want to put in your go bag, but obviously you can't carry everything for everywhere. There are times when I've had to be away and keep one with a little bit of everything because I never know. I could get launched anywhere from the Arctic to the desert. So I can mix a bunch of things into one bag, which basically makes me ill-prepared for any event. But if I've got the time, you try to put your bag together based on – it's pretty much the same major groups that they talk about in survival training or in wilderness survival or any survival. You've got your energy, water, shelter, signaling, first aid, security because you're doing a job, but you have to be prepared for any eventuality. So packing a go bag for San Francisco in July, some of those things I can – probably put away and leave behind. A little bit different than getting launched to the Amazon jungle or Mongolia or something like that. So we try to make sure that bag is something that is a little bit weight and size conscious. When we launch on the FAA airplane, we're generally filling up a Gulfstream. There's only so many great big bags full of tools we can fit in any biz jet. But you kind of group them into our personal safety items. So I want to make sure that I'm prepared for the safety issues that are on a crash site. We've got jagged metal, composite fibers, fire hazards, hazmat hazards. So we've got our respirators and our Tyvek suits and rubber gloves and rubber booties that go all there. That's pretty universal because any airplane's going to have that kind of stuff going on. Any hardware that I think I need for investigative. As the IIC, I'm not getting too far down into the rivets and the nuts and the bolts, but you do want some basic stuff. And when I go overseas, sometimes I do need just a basic toolkit of my own. I've learned to do a lot with a Leatherman. Various things for just taking measurements, taking documentation. Used to be you'd carry around lots of tape measures and scales and things like that. Now you can load them all onto your iPad. There's great apps for that kind of thing, which is great. And then there's the environmental survival gear. Obviously, didn't need too much of that in San Francisco, but you need to have some hot weather gear if that's where you're headed, cold weather gear if that's where you're headed. The hot weather gear, you definitely want a lot of bug protection. I've learned that the hard way. Bees in the Amazon was a big one, but that was not an issue in San Francisco. Did want to, no matter where you're at, you're going to need that water. Hydration out on scene, we're spending and I'll get to this later on, but many, many hours out in the middle of a runway, an airport, and you can start to run yourself ragged pretty fast. And a Camelback for hydration is definitely key. So that's in there. Again, depending on where we're going, shelter might be necessary. You know, tarps, space blankets, things like that in the bag are good to have. The survival folks would say signaling. Well, when in a survival situation, that's so you can, you know, get rescued and get out of there. But in our case, it's getting information back to the boss, which means all of our electronic comms gear. Could be basic stuff like the iPad and the cell phones, or depending where we're at, could be satellite phones, PLB locators. Again, that's more for the security end of it. But we definitely want to have that. This is an investigative job, so we've got a lot of things. Again, I mentioned documentation. We keep a whole evidence kit to keep records of where things are, where we harvested things. That's in the bag. Obviously, there's always a portable GPS in there and a notepad, just old school writing things down. Because I can always drop that iPad in the mud and it's not going to survive. But an old school notebook, I can drop it in the mud and it keeps working. Let's see what else I've got in there. I've got some paracord in there. I always have those. Snacks, food. You never know when you're going to eat, depending on where you're at. Little photo tags, those little evidence markers with the numbers on them for putting in your photograph so you remember what's what. Little spray bottle. A lot of people carry that around with floor wax or water for composite fiber. That's a big issue on scene, so we want to make sure that we keep safe around that stuff. And then we've got all our forms to record everything. We're the government agency, so we have to have standard forms. Those are all in there. Our own personal safety, health, first aid type of things. For those of us who travel overseas, obviously we have to keep our passport up to date, but also all our shots and medications. So make sure I have that in there. Some malaria pills are in there. Some water purification tabs are in there. And then the record of all the various inoculations and shots that I've had to have for the various places around the world. Sunscreen's a good one. Definitely want to have that one in there for cold or hot. And I could dump this whole thing out and it would sound like Fibber McGee's closet, but as you can see, we've got a lot of different categories to pack in there. Fortunately, again, for San Francisco, there wasn't a wilderness type of thing, but a lot of that stuff still will apply.
So as you're on the FAA plane heading for San Francisco, are you gathering more information, or is more information being provided to you, or are you sort of in the dark until you arrive?
Well, it's a little of both. So I'm throwing that together, and the phone is just ringing off the hook. So everybody who's got something to contribute wants to get a hold of the IIC. Sure, we've got support back in the offices. Other investigators who aren't traveling will start taking things in. But we build a team with parties from other organizations that have to do with the accident. Manufacturer of the airframe, manufacturer of engines, and other significant hardware like avionics. If there's a pilot's union involved, they'll be ringing the phone. If the airline has a presence in the States, they'll be trying to get in touch with us. And at the same time, we'll be trying to get in touch with first responders, local authorities that are out there, the airport authority, perhaps if there's an FBI, we have a close relationship with the FBI. If they have a presence on or near the accident location, air marshals or TSA, if it's on an airport, we'll be trying to get in touch with them. So there's a lot of that going on, trying to get the information square, what really happened, where things are. In this case, I started hearing wildly different numbers of casualties. We heard many different stories about just the condition of the wreckage, whether the tail section was in the water or not. And at first, I think we've all seen the video now of the airplane doing the almost, not really a cartwheel, but
pretty close
spin. Yeah, pretty close. That spin maneuver, almost a pirouette-looking maneuver. We hadn't seen that originally, and we heard the first thing that we heard was airplane cartwheeled. Then the first photos came out, and it looked pretty intact. Wings attached to a fuselage in an airplane shape. And we thought, well, that can't be right. How could it cartwheel? We thought cartwheel was like Sioux City, where you know the airplane was spread out all over, and so that can't be right. And then, of course, later on, we saw the video, and yeah, sure enough, it really was. But nobody knew at the time just exactly how that maneuver went and where all the damage was and where the casualties would be. So that's you get a bunch of different stories there. Then one of the big things we want to do is get that site secured. Now, on a major international airport, it's not too hard. So the airport itself is already responding based on their own emergency plan to secure the airplane in the scene. We want to make sure that perishable items are harvested right away. So in this case, the black boxes, the recorders, those are high priority items to get. In this case, while we're scrambling around and heading for DC and getting on the FAA airplane, we got in touch with one of our regional investigators, one of the general aviation folks who wasn't too far from San Francisco. And she started heading straight to the airport for just that mission. While we were traveling, we were working through sat phone on the FAA airplane with air marshals to meet her on scene and get the boxes out of the airplane, if we could even find them. At this point, remember, we didn't know the tail section might have been in the water, and we might have been looking at a water recovery for that. But
can you swim?
Yeah. Well, yeah, and if you looked in that water there, I don't know if you'd really want to. It's kind of a mucky bottom and more like a swamp. That would have been a real tough scene to have to get into that water out there in San Francisco Bay.
But would they have done that to you? I mean, are you guys also the people that would don the scuba gear and go in, or do they basically hire out a firm and say, no, here's what we're looking for, you guys go down?
Right. Yeah. Normally, we would use some experts to do that, depending on the type of location. Domestically, in relatively shallow water, in inshore like this, FBI does have a dive team, and we have an agreement with FBI to use them. So we probably would have been able to mobilize an FBI dive team, or perhaps Coast Guard, or I would suspect San Francisco Fire Department has a capability as well, but I do know FBI does. We also have an agreement with the Navy for deep water recovery. So when we've worked on things like the Alaska Air MD-80 off of Los Angeles, that was worked with the U.S. Navy and their contractors to do the deep water recovery. Same with TW-800 near New York. So no, NTSB folks don't put on the diving bell and go down and pick that up.
Okay.
We do a lot of leveraging with these support organizations. Just like we did, you know, as I'm talking about with the black boxes, as it turned out, of course, the tail was up on the runway. They weren't that hard to recover. So our investigator managed to get them out with some help from some of the airline mechanics that were on scene pretty easily, and got those into the hands of the air marshals, who could then, you know, ride jump seat on a commercial flight, actually, that was flying a red-eye back to D.C. So, in fact, we were arriving at San Francisco on the FAA airplanes just about the same time the commercial airplane was pulling out and heading back east. So those boxes were in the lab by, I think, 6 a.m. the next day, which was a pretty fast turnaround. So our lab could start working on those right away.
Have any of the investigations ever caught you in a spot where you were just in the middle of something that you really, you know, maybe a weekend getaway that you were trying to squeeze in, even though you were on call and you thought, oh, I made it, and then the phone went off or something like
that? Oh, more often than not, yeah, because a major accident doesn't happen all that often, so you it's not like you're running down the bat pole in the fire station every few hours. So sure, that happens sometimes, but we do have our quick turnaround, and that's part of what we know about our job, is that sometimes we just have to drop those things we've looked forward to. I've missed the occasional concert tickets we've had to be given away or something like that occasionally. That's just par for the course for the job.
Yeah. So you guys really don't have a bat pole, though, or anything?
No, not actually a bat pole. That would be cool, though. That would be all right.
I know this is a dumb question, but where is NTSB headquarters at exactly?
So the
don't know.
Yeah, the headquarters is right downtown D.C. It's in L'Enfant Plaza, which is in the southwest part of D.C., just across the river from Reagan National Airport.
Bill, are there certain kinds of investigations that the investigators, well, like or dislike, you know, like to be assigned to or wish they weren't assigned to?
I don't know if there's anything that we don't like being assigned to. I mean, that's once it gets in your blood, I mean, I think we'd investigate just about anything. You know, there's always parts of it that some people, you know, thrive on more than others. But I think we're the kind of people that would just – we'd investigate anything. Mm. I mean, Charlie Brown's kite in the tree, we'd be happy to go and investigate that.
Well, now, do you do other things besides aviation? I mean, would they send you out on a pipeline or a hazmat spill or anything like that?
Well, the board does. We are multimodal. I personally am in aviation major investigations only. There is a little bit of overlap. Occasionally, someone will go from one to another, cross-training. And some of our specialties work across the board. Our meteorologists tend to support all the modes, the laboratories, the recorders folks do. But generally, people stay with one mode, although in what we call the surface modes, the rail and hazmat and highway, there's quite a bit more overlap. Although there's been times when we've had such things. Sometimes we'd support the marine folks when there's issues with things like, you know, radar and the recorders type of things and controls. I remember there was one where we did cross over because of the type of ship actually had certain airfoil controls and everything. So kind of worked together with them.
All right, Bill, take us now through the now that you've arrived at San Francisco, there must be some kind of a command center or something that gets set up, I would imagine.
Exactly. Now we have to start eating the elephant. So we've scrambled and we got there and we arrived in the middle of the night. So started out with just a general on-scene review, see what we've got out there. But we have to start setting up our command post. That's going to be my headquarters for the investigative part. For folks who are familiar with emergency response, you've probably heard of ICS, or the Incident Command System, that the fire, police, and other first responders will put together, which is an integrated system. And we do work with that, but the command post for us is to run the investigation itself, the safety investigation, where I'll start to pull in the different parties, and that's our headquarters for that. In this case, we were coordinated with the airline there. That's a major hub at San Francisco is United, and they are code share with Asiana. So they stepped in to assist them with dealing with survivors and family members, and they were able to offer up a location on the airport that we could use for the command post. I've got some pictures you guys might put up on the website if you want to, what that looks like. But we start to integrate everybody in into that room, and we'll organize. We started the first thing in the morning, so it's going to be a secure area where we'll start to arrange internet, printers, all the things that everyone needs to start compiling everything they need there. Some storage, you know, secure storage for evidence that gets picked up that we need to, get away from the scene, get out of the elements or so on. So we put that together. That was on airport. But of course, now we've got to deal with getting from this building, getting through security there, and then moving a rapidly growing number of people to and from the site that's in the middle of an airport, which, you know, we can't just drive in and out willy-nilly on a secure operating international airport. So first thing the next morning, I do what's called an organizational meeting, bring in everybody who started coming from the four corners of the country and whereabouts, and introducing the parties to the investigation. The FAA folks would be there, Boeing, in this case, Pratt & Whitney for engines, Honeywell participates with all the avionics that they had. And we were starting to get a little bit of a story in already, so knowing what we wanted to look at out at the airport first thing in the morning, but started to organize that sort of pyramid structure that I have of different investigative groups. So I'll set those up as well, led by NTSB investigators. We'll have an operations group, systems, structures of the airplane, engines, and so on. So that's what's starting up in the command post. Now, as you can probably have seen in some of the videos, this accident clearly had a lot of wreckage and debris on the runway that of intended landing, 28 left. But a lot of debris also went over onto 28 right and was seriously impacting the airport. So pretty much at not long after first light, we started to get a team out there right away to document and help the airport clear 28 right so that the airport can open again. We started to have serious impact with the international flights, the heavies. So working with them, we got that runway cleared and opened pretty much by the middle of the day of the first day while we'd split the team and then have people start to work on perishable items in the main wreckage. So getting up into cockpit and documenting switches and getting paperwork and materials out of there quickly before it got moved around, or especially paperwork starts to get moved around, and if there was any residual fire, we want to make sure we get that stuff out of there quickly. So we had the team split with that, and I'll have to say right now a lot of kudos to the support organizations that help us out with that. The FBI evidence response team, who we work with all the time. You'd see that if you were close to a scene, you'll see a lot of FBI uniforms around as well, FBI windbreakers. That doesn't mean that there's a crime or that this is, means there's terrorism or anything like that. That's just part of our normal working relationship with FBI, and their evidence response team mobilizes along with us so we can leverage them. We'll get another couple dozen people in who are just excellent at documenting and gathering evidence. Because we just don't have the manpower to keep on staff all the time to do such a thing. The airport authority itself, of course, worked very smoothly with us. Obviously, they were under great pressure to get the airport reopened. And so we worked well hand in hand to get that going. United Airlines deserves a lot of credit for the support that they gave us out there as well, supplying heavy equipment. They supplied ramp space to move the large parts of the wreckage too for a while, and of course they were there to support Asiana as well with the families and the survivors, because obviously Asiana didn't have a lot of staff here in the States. And so the Red Cross
I was going to say, so the whole airport was shut down for roughly how long?
Well, the whole airport was shut until early in the morning. We got the cross runways open early in the morning, and then we had 28 right open again, if I recall, by early afternoon of the next day. That's still a pretty big impact, though. Losing 28 left was a big impact to them and that was 5 days, I think, we had to keep that runway closed. Wow. Maybe a little longer. I forget exactly. So, that was one other organization I just forgot to mention. I do want to give credit to Red Cross, who came out supporting, all those first responders and our guys, and just did a terrific job with us. They help out as well. Both Red Cross and FBI helped out a lot with our site security. We had to keep, even though we are on the grounds of a Part 139 airport, so people can't just go wandering by. We still have to maintain a perimeter because there's other things going on as well. And that perimeter is the same kind of thing we would do even if we weren't on an airport. Just a few weeks later, the UPS accident in Birmingham was off airport, an outside controlled area. So we had to set up, again, a secure perimeter around the wreckage site so that only people who have a reason to be in there, who have the training to be able to be on an accident site, can go through. We set up a decon area for getting into and out of the protective gear, rinsing off the any contaminants that you might have on, residue from fire, the composite fibers, things like that. So we want a clean area for that. And then a sort of a buddy system as well, people signing in, signing out, that we don't get someone inside the area and then lose them. I mean, a 777 or an Airbus is a pretty big environment, and someone can start digging around in part of that airplane. And just like any other hazardous environment, without a buddy system, you don't want someone lost and hurt. There's a lot of physical hazards in there, so that's one of the reasons why we keep this the site pretty contained and try to keep looky-loos out of there. This, however, was a huge amount of people that we had on top of this. First fatal Part 121 air carrier accident in the States in 5 years. So we had, of our own people, we brought out some folks who hadn't had the experience before for training. We had observers coming in from other organizations all over the world, not just the States. We had some military investigators coming in for familiarization. Some AIBs from at least four other countries came in to observe. And then just the support that we needed as well. At one point, my sign-in log in the command post topped 110 people.
Amazing. That's
probably, yeah. So it's not just herding cats. It's herding a lot of cats.
Yeah, but what do you do when you guys need food? I mean, do you call Domino's and say 40 pizzas?
Well, you know, that's where the Red Cross came in very handy. They were terrific at supporting a lot of that. And sometimes, yeah, that's exactly what we do. we'll grab one or two people and say, just go on a, you know, raid Five Guys Burgers, and that's what we get. Because people don't want to take a break or can't. If you're out in the middle of an airport, you think about the logistics it takes to. We were using rental car shuttle buses to take people back and forth from the secure area out to, you know, from the secure area into the hangar where our command post was and back again. So there was a lot of logistics involved in that. So Red Cross out on scene helped, and then sometimes it was just literally like that. And you're out there for a very long day. We're trying to eat that elephant now. Now we've got 400,000 pounds of airplane to document. Where do we start? What do we do? Well, that's what I do. I take that 110 people and place them out there. Now, most of our people know their role pretty well. But we've got to organize that and hit the high priorities first. Get those people on this job, hit the perishable evidence hard and fast, get it documented, because again, we also have to get it out of there. The first, I think it was Tuesday, was the first day we had with some not so good weather, and the traffic acceptance rate at the airport went down. There were 140 international cancellations at San Francisco. I mean, that's a huge impact, and we're very aware of that, that we've got to get our job done correctly, but also done efficiently. So that's a long day out there. That's 16-hour days. We're working from first light to last light, documenting every bit of the evidence that's out there. And then as other things come in, interview summaries come in, information from the black boxes comes in, making sure we go back and we've done everything right with the physical evidence on scene. So eating that elephant in a very logical manner, without just, you know, 100 people swarming all around without any kind of direction, is what we've got to do to get that done in such a short period of time.
Is there any prioritization of the data collection, the evidence collection? I mean, I'm thinking you mentioned some perishable evidence and things, and there's probably also things like people that need to be interviewed but who will drift off and be more difficult to find later.
Absolutely. A lot of the perishable, some of it is environmental perishable, things like the paperwork that was in the cockpit, dispatch papers, approach charts, things like that. That's perishable. The depending on the elements that we have, and this accident, it wasn't so bad. The weather was great. There was hardly any rain or anything like that. So some electronics and things like that, though, in worse weather conditions, we may want to make sure that we get that out, get that into a safe area. Obviously, the black boxes that I already mentioned are one of the highest priority things to do. But the human evidence is definitely perishable. If there's if we had a deceased flight crew, which we didn't, thankfully, in this case, there is some, you know, postmortem testing that the coroner does, and there's some the FAA Medical Institute in Oklahoma. We'll do some of that postmortem testing.
That'd be like drugs and alcohol, that kind of thing.
Drug and alcohol testing, CO2 type of thing as well, to see if there was some, say, hypoxia impairment, that type of thing, or you know, maybe chemicals or whatever in the aircraft. So that type of thing is definitely time critical. and just interviews in general with surviving flight crew, surviving cabin crew, passengers that might have witnessed anything, or eyewitnesses nearby. People's memories fade and change, so it's very important to get to them in a timely manner. In this case, we had an enormous amount of people to interview. There were eyewitnesses everywhere. Plenty of video. Video, of course, isn't perishable. It's not going to change, but just to go out and get it. But we had hundreds of passengers to talk to. We had the three flight crew who were up in front, and the cabin crew in the back. There was a total of 12. Some were hospitalized and couldn't talk right away, but as soon as we could, you know, we'd want to. And a lot of folks, again, as we mentioned, people's memories change, or sometimes there's some fear and reticence of that, or people just don't want to sit around in a strange country waiting for somebody to interview them. So we want to do that as quickly as possible so that they can, you know, get on with their lives and get back to home and some kind of sense of normalcy. So that led to long days. And of course, adding to that complication was translation, because we had quite a number of non-English speakers involved, both on the crew and cabin and the passengers as well. So that that does take some time as well, just to get some help in there with translating. We got some assistance from airlines, from other government agencies to do that. But at the last minute, that's a difficult thing to do. So we did do that, actually. And again, with flight crew especially, we learn things from some of the data we get, and we might go back. We'll talk about the hearing in a minute, but you'll see that some of the flight crew were interviewed a couple, three, even four times, I think, on one of them. So as new data comes in, we'll take the opportunity to go back and say, okay, we've learned some new stuff. Let's talk to you about that. That's just gathering the evidence. The other part of what I'm doing out here, there's plenty more as well. The tin kicking part, the investigation, is obviously what I need to do the safety results. But there's also the public side of this. The public wants to know what's going on, and that's where our board member, in this case our chairman, who was on scene, comes into play. And we saw Chairman Herzman on the media right there. She launched with us and served as our spokesman on scene. So I'm also constantly working with the chairman in this case, or whichever board member might be on scene, and our media folks, and our other people who liaison with government affairs. So the local politicians, governor or congressional representatives, who of course are very interested in this as well. And then the family assistants, the families and survivors who are also clamoring for information. We have a constant flow from our investigative staff to translate that into something that's accessible for lay people like the survivors or the media, that the chairman and the other functions can put out as well. So the day gets pretty long. We start out briefing on what we're going to work on. We're working out on the airplane or with the data all day long. By the evening, there's the need for media briefings, working with the local authorities, and providing information to the families and survivors as well.
Well, no, it's fairly unusual for the chairman to go to an accident scene, isn't it?
Well, the board members, actually, they do a go team rotation as well. They only do launch domestically, however. By statute, they don't really have an authority when we go overseas. That's a different agreement. I'm not sure how often they go, but I do know the chairman has launched on a number of accidents in different modes, and they do a rotation as well.
Yeah, she's more involved than any chairman I remember, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, she definitely is involved and is a great believer in getting the information out to the public as well. So does quite a lot of media functions as well.
Do you ever have a time where you just sort of go through sensory overload? Does the procedures and everything else just sort of take over for you? Or do you have a point where you sort of go, whoa, is it really just all the next steps, or do you have time to breathe and maybe sort of take it all in?
Great question, David. I love that question. And you know, the first day or two, it is pretty much just the blast from the fire hose. No two accidents are the same, and even as you know, I've been at this now for over 14 years. So, and I'll say it's, you know, they're just not the same. The environment's different. The circumstances are different all the time. So you fall back on your basics, but it is just this incredible. You just, it's like riding the bucking bronco for the first few days. Try to keep it together, and then it's usually about 3 days in or so. Once everything's kind of ticking and everybody knows where they need to be and things are falling into place, I always get to that one point where I stop and I'm thinking, what's next? What's next? What do I have to do next? And there isn't a next for a minute or two. And then I think, either it's all running now, I got it going, it's running on autopilot, or I just forgot something really important and I got to think about what it is. But generally, that's the cycle. That first maybe 48 hours, maybe 72 hours, it's very random, and you just have to fall back on your basics and your judgment at that point to see how it works. And that sometimes that 72 hours is very compressed, especially when we go overseas, where a huge chunk of that 72 hours is spent just getting there.
Well, what's the longest investigation you've ever been out on?
Let's see. I've been, I think probably Brazil probably was time-wise the longest, just because the accessibility was pretty poor getting out into the jungle, and we had a lot to do in various spread out locations. So I think on the initial launch I was probably down there for a couple 3 weeks. Water recoveries take a long time, but I kind of don't count that, because with the water recoveries a lot of times you're just sitting around twiddling your thumbs waiting for something to happen. So there's been a few of those where, you know, you spend a week or so just, you know, watching the boat go back and forth trying to find things. But typically we can get, if we've got good support, we can get something, the on-scene part, wrapped up within 2 weeks. And that was how it worked here as well. We got the main part of the wreckage. Well, we got it off the runway and off the infield area there by, I think it was Thursday. Don't quote me on the exact day. So it was definitely less than a week. We got the runway reopened and the stuff off the infield, moved the majority of the wreckage over to a ramp area that was not in the way, with some you know, heavy equipment, a boneyard that we'd worked with before, and managed to get that fuselage and wings slinged up and moved over there. It's not easy to move a 777 that's not quite an entire 777 anymore. They're kind of heavy. And once the gear's broken off and the tail's broken off, we can't just push them around with a tug. So that took probably a full day in itself, just crawling it over to a place where we could keep working on it. And we did have to section it a little bit, chop the aft end of it off just to get it over. And then we could get inside and do a lot more examination in the cabin. So that if we add it together, we had to come back later on to do some of that structural examination, get inside, look at the fire path. So if I add it together, probably a total of 3 weeks of on scene.
And where is that wreckage now? Is it in the same place?
No, we sectioned it up. The airport needed that area. It's over near a maintenance hangar, so it couldn't stay there forever. So we sectioned that up, and it's moved over to a secure, undisclosed storage location that I can still get at if I need to, but it's out of the way of the airport.
I can imagine that the airport would like to get that removed, just because of, you know, how it looks to other, you know, flights coming and going.
Oh yeah, no doubt. So our next step, we've gone out there and crawled all over this wreckage, and now we have to put all those pieces together, and that sort of takes us to our hearing that we just held last week.
Tell us what was the intent of the hearing? What objective does that hearing have, and is it one of many or several that will occur?
Yeah, public hearing. Well, public hearing is what they used to call it. Now they say investigative hearing. That's a normal legal part of our process. It serves two purposes in a major investigation. It is a formal way to introduce factual information into the investigation. If you noticed, for those of you that did watch it or saw it online, the witnesses that gave testimony, they were all sworn in, just like in a court. This is taken down by a court reporter. This is actual testimony, and they are giving information for the record. For the most part, we have developed the framework of that information already. We certainly weren't twiddling our thumbs from July until December, and we'd been gathering information. Well, there was 16 days in there where we were twiddling our thumbs, but that's a different story.
That's a different story, yes. Yeah.
But this is actual formal putting that putting those pieces together for our information docket, and at the same time, it's also showing the public basically your government at work, showing you, yes, we are still here, we are still working on this, and determining the cause, and gives the public some insight into what's been going on and what we know so far, rather than just we go you know, behind closed doors and, you know, like the artists say, you can't see it till it's finished. No, we part of the whole point of the way the board works is to do our work in the public eye, so you can sort of see it happening as we're doing it. So you could see a lot of the major subject areas that that we're interested in.
Is that a change, or is that something? Is it always been that way?
Oh no, public hearing has been that's been part of the major process for as long as I can remember.
Okay, Rob, yeah. You had something.
Bill, you mentioned something that I was going to ask you about. You said it's not like we've been sitting around twiddling our thumbs since July. Can you give us a little idea of, once the investigation was completed in San Francisco and you head back to NTSB headquarters, give us a little bit of an idea of what happened with all the stuff that you gathered.
You're right. Great question. So we've got a lot of data that we got out of a flight recorders and just knowledge of the systems of the airplane. So we had to look at that flight recorder. A flight recorder doesn't come out like a movie. When we download that into the lab, it doesn't just show you immediately, here it is, and it looks just like, you know, I don't know, CSI or something, where you see all the everything happen and know exactly why. It's a lot of squiggly lines that you then have to put together and understand in context with how a complicated airplane like a 777 works. So that was one avenue of things. We had to sit down with subject matter experts from Boeing and from Honeywell and others, and understand when this squiggly line happens here and this squiggly line happens at the same time, what do we think is really going on in the airplane and why? And A, is that what's supposed to happen, or is something breaking? So go back through and see, does this data match the systems in the airplane? That's one step. We have to go back and look at the hardware itself that's significant here. In this case, auto throttles. There's various switches and controls on the auto flight panel. Those were physically torn down, vibration tested, x-rayed, examined to make sure, yep, those switches actually are working the way they're supposed to work. We'd have to do some analysis. We worked on the air traffic control radar, low altitude alerting systems in there to make sure they were working the way they were supposed to. The EGPWS in the airplane, again, a study on that to see could this or did this, you know, give a warning when it was supposed to. The low airspeed alerting, you heard some of that discussion in the hearing. Did that system work as designed? So we have to feed a lot of data back. So a lot of this is computerized work to understand what was going on. Is this the way it's supposed to happen, or is something broken? There's a human element as well. We also went back to look into the training and the background of the pilots, the people who trained the pilots, who oversaw their training. So we traveled to Korea and conducted 20 or so different interviews of training pilots, Czech airmen, and so on, understand the structure of the airline, understand the structure of the oversight that's done by the Korean authorities, and other pilots who flew with the accident crew as well. Get a little bit of a background on their skill and their behavior, get their 72-hour history for before the flight, their sleep and their eating and their health habits prior to the flight. All that stuff needed to get documented. And I just have to go through all the different subject matters that we had there. Everyone's basically building that up and then building up the whole environment of what we were looking at as well. How are people trained in a general sense in automated aircraft, and doing a lot of research there into some of the academic studies that had been done, making sure we compile a lot of that as well. So all that had been going on in that intervening time from July to November to take that whole big picture. You can see the three main elements that we always look at in an investigation: the man, the machine, and the environment. So the man, you know, the actual flight crew themselves, their performance, their behavior, their health, and so on, the human factors there, their training. And then the machine itself, understand it. Is the data telling us is it telling us this is the way things are supposed to happen? Is something broken? Was something mismanaged? And then try to get to those answers and the environment that whole thing took place in.
Bill, you had to go to Korea to enter. What kind of diplomatic, how does that work? I mean, you don't just fly over there and start interviewing people. Does the State Department get involved? How much cooperation or lack of cooperation have when you start interviewing, foreign nationals for here in the United States?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Most of that is covered under the Annex 13, which is part of the ICAO treaty, the International Civil Aeronautics Organization treaty. There is a section that determines how international overlap works. So for this accident in particular, I have a counterpart at the Korean KARAIB. It's hard to say. But they have an accredited rep as well, who's basically my equivalent for Korea, who serves as our conduit into the aviation system of Korea. So that's the coordination that I officially use to get at Asiana Airlines or the KOCA, the Civil Aviation Authority over there. The State Department does get involved, of course, because especially with something of this high a level, there's going to be higher level government interest as well. So they're there to, you know, basically smooth the way for our travel and then our interaction with the Korean officials. But for the most part, it's pretty well handled already by Annex 13. And frankly, we do this all the time. Mostly it's the other way around. I end up traveling to other countries as an ACRIP to do the same thing because of U.S. manufacture most of the time. But we're pretty used to this. In fact, I think I've been to Korea four times before on different accidents, so I knew a lot of the folks over there anyway. But there is a level of diplomacy involved as well. And actually, following our trip, which was more down in the weeds investigation, our chairman did make a more diplomatic level trip over there as well to meet the chairman of the AIB and the CEO of Asiana and so on as well to keep that relationship going.
So what's the result?
Well, the last few days we're all just taking a deep breath and relaxing after the hearing, because that was an enormous amount of work, never mind the snowstorm that threw a whole monkey wrench in the thing. So, yes, after our marathon 12-hour-long hearing day of pulling all this in, and I sure hope that people get a chance to at least look at some of the high points online, and we'll send some links. Max, maybe you can put them up in the show notes or something.
Yeah, absolutely.
To take a look at some of that. There was a lot of really great information there from SMEs from all over the airline, from Boeing and so on, really explaining this complicated system in this airplane and the sequence of events that occurred all through the approach leading to the impact and beyond. Also a lot of good information about survival factors as well, the survivability aspects of seat design and cabin design, issues that we're still working on with, as you heard, a couple of the slides inflated within the cabin, clearly not an optimal situation. And then the emergency response issues as well were explored. So a lot of good information in there that we're digesting and putting together to try to tell this story clearly now. I think we've got a good start from the hearing. So now I've got to assemble all this into a final report. I'll tell the sequence of events, explain this complicated auto flight system and the training that's given to pilots, whether it's, you know, physical training in a simulator or on the line, or the manuals and the documents that support that training. Do we have issues in any of those areas there? The human factors effects, I don't think it's any secret. People have been looking at the increasing automation and how does that affect people's flying skills and situational awareness and so on as years have progressed. And so what we're doing, you mentioned, do we have another thing like that hearing? sort of we do at the end of all of this. Once I take all this information that we saw and heard in that hearing, the next 6 months is now assembling that into our final report, where we will actually draw conclusions. We will have analysis of all this information, draw conclusions, determine a probable cause, and safety recommendations to make warranted changes. That will come out in the final report. They call it the blue cover. It's a you've seen them recently, the Colgan Airlines accident, same format as that, basically. And we will have another public meeting, a little bit different in this case. We won't be taking testimony. This is where staff, meaning me and my team, will be presenting that report, the draft report, to the board, to Chairman Herzman and the other members of the board, for their deliberation and voting and adoption of the report and the probable cause. That's another open process. Anybody can go and attend. Nobody talks except for staff and the board, but you can all see it happen. And sometimes some of the conclusions and probable cause are changed somewhat in there through the course of the deliberation. But at the end of that process, we have a final report, a cause, and some number of recommendations. We could put out recommendations before. That's always a possibility. There aren't any so far, but there could be prior to the report ending. And there almost always are in a blue cover some safety recommendations at the end of the process.
Do you guys have to agree, or not you guys, but does the board essentially look at the results, and do they as a board have to be unanimous that they agree with the conclusions?
No, they don't. They do have to vote in a majority. It is possible to have a dissent. Generally speaking, they don't have a dissenting vote, but there are sometimes they call them concurring statements or non-concurring statements. It's sort of like how the Supreme Court judges write those opinions explaining how they voted or how they would have liked a thing to come out. There's a few of those around. In general, we like to think that by the time we get to the board meeting, there shouldn't be too much dramatic dissent. It can happen, and it has, but not terribly often. Staff always likes to present a report that all the board members are going to vote in favor of, because otherwise our recommendations aren't going to have a lot of weight if we can't even get the board to agree to us. The other part that could have some differences of opinion is a process that's called submissions, where we open our process and our information, all our public docket, to all the parties that participate. So the analysis and that conclusions, it's not just Bill and his team coming up with these ideas, but all those party participants who worked with us through the process, they get a crack at it as well. The U.S. parties can put in their own proposed probable cause, their own findings, etc. And the international participants under Annex 13 actually get a review of our draft final prior to it going to the board, and can make comments to that with, they see our analysis and our conclusions.
And that docket of information's up on the NTSB website now, isn't it? Because that first hearing's already been held.
That's correct. So the initial docket's up there. That's the majority of it, but more things will be going in between now and early next year as we finish up some of the remaining items left over from after the hearing.
Yeah, and I was just up there looking, and it's up to 121 separate exhibits at this point. So we'll have to see where it ends up before the conclusions or the probable causes are organized.
It won't be small. Yep.
Bill, do you often find certain parties that have some interest in this to try to exert influence or pressure on the investigation? Does that happen?
Oh, I think everybody tries to influence. I think it's human nature that anyone would have. Everyone wants to see things in their own point of view. That's just human nature. I don't really see anything that's really undue. I mean, I've never heard of anyone doing anything borderline criminal or anything like that. But certainly, everybody's got their own point of view and their own agendas to look at. That's normal.
So you bought that brand new Porsche you've been driving on your own money, then, right?
Exactly. From mowing lawns on the weekend. Yeah,
exactly. Okay. Actually, you know, one thing that might be interesting to our listeners from outside the U.S. is, could you maybe explain a little hierarchy of the NTSB, say at the chairman level? Who does the chairman and the board and all, who do they report to?
So the chairman and the board, which are five people, they are political appointees. So they are appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate. So they're roughly equivalent, not exactly, but to a cabinet level secretary, like Secretary of DOT or something. So in effect, they report to the president. We are independent. We're not part of the Department of Transportation or anyone else. So they're separate from any of those influences as well. That's why we can make recommendations against or to the FAA, to DOT, or so on. We're not making a recommendation to our boss. They're the political appointees. All the rest of us are our staff. We're just regular old government workers.
That's wild. Now, and there isn't another, or I don't believe there's an equivalent to the NTSB somewhere else in the federal government, is there? It's completely independent like this?
Oh, I actually don't know the answer to that. There might be in some other areas that I'm not familiar with. I don't know.
Maybe like the Office of Management and Budget? Something like that? Is that what you're thinking about, Rob?
Yeah, I was just trying to imagine somebody else that was at that same secretary level that went right to the White House without somebody in between.
Federal Reserve Chairman.
There you go. Good one.
Yeah. There's an example.
Okay.
So, Bill, the final report, is there a target date for that, or is it more the sort of thing where it's done when it's done?
Well, we don't want to be too artificial about it, but I think the chairman has already announced that our goal is to have it done within a year. So I suspect that it'll be done within about a year.
I think that some people find that seems like an awful long period of time, a whole year to do an investigation. But really, when you think about all the aspects of it that you've laid out, it's not a slow pace.
Yeah, it's not. The investigation itself, we've been working hard to get to where we're at now. But then to put all this together into a story that's coherent is not an easy process. And to do it with all and keep everybody integrated as well, all the parties. And don't forget, almost any airline accident nowadays is going to have an international facet to it. So that sticks an extra 2 months on automatically just by treaty that we have to give the involved foreign country the 60-day review period at the end.
Sure.
Yeah.
Bill, okay, so you've got another year before the end of this report. Are you locked into this investigation? What happens if there's another accident? God forbid. Do you then start over again and you're running more than one at one time?
Yeah. So actually, it's not a year from now. It would be a year from the accident date that the chairman was targeting. So July of 2014, we should be finished. So what's today? We're recording this on Monday the 16th. A week from now, I'll be on call again. So yeah, I could pick up another one.
Wow. Yay.
Bill, something I'm curious about is, as a journalist, I've always found that writing by committee is a nightmare. And I'm just curious, when a final report comes together, do you have different people that are responsible for perhaps writing up the meteorological conditions, and another one looks at the pilot qualifications, and another one looks at the way the equipment worked in the airplane, and then it all kind of gets tossed together, or how does that work?
That is how it works, actually. So all those investigative group chairmen that we had out there in San Francisco, so that 10 or so NTSB specialists, operations it would be, that looks at the pilots and, let's say, systems, or looks at the how the avionics would work. So that particular investigator writes a factual report or reports, sometimes more. That's mostly what you're seeing in the docket now. They also put together what's called their analysis, where they take their subject matter and draw conclusions, recommendations, and sort of look at it from their point of view, what was the cause of the accident. That's really where the meat of what I'm doing at this point comes from now, is integrating all of that. So I'll take 10 or a dozen different analyses from those folks and their 121 plus different exhibits worth of material to build a report. Fortunately, I also have the assistance of a tech writer. We have a technical writing staff, so another half a dozen of those folks who do nothing but write the large reports. So I'll be working together with her. And most of our tech writers are former, not all of them, but many of them are former investigators themselves. So we will assemble this thing. So in some ways, it is writing by committee, but when it gets right down to it, it's really just the two of us.
Amazing. Well, the results have been quite good over the years, I think, Bill. I think everybody respects the investigations that the NTSB does. It's sort of a testament to the not only the people involved in it all, but the processes that are used to conduct these investigations. So it's very good.
Yeah, we like to think so. We like to keep that process and that concept and what the board means going. It's not about the individual, whoever's on the board or on the staff, but the idea of what we do.
For sure. All right. Well, Bill English, thank you so much for walking us through this this process. It's been really fascinating. I'm sure we all have lots of other questions and things that we'd like to know about, but that's kind of as much time as we can give it this episode. But certainly, we'd love to have you back in the future and explore things in more detail or explore other aspects of this. So,
well, maybe we can have him back after the final report is completed on the Asiana accident.
Sure.
I'd like an invitation to see the presentation for the final paper.
Yeah, that would be interesting, huh?
I mean, it's only 2 hours away, 2.5 hours away if it's in D.C.
Yeah.
Oh, here's your invitation. Come on down.
Okay, we'll be there.
Yeah. All right, good.
Hey, Bill, one last question. Now, Max, you can cut this out if you want. I'm just curious, where is TWA 800 at?
We still have it. It's in our academy, which is near but not at Dulles.
Oh, I see. Okay.
There's occasions when journalistic types or aviation education can come in and see it. When we run our school, generally that's part of it is a quick tour of it as well. But you had some reason you wanted to come see it, you Rob have got certainly the credentials that you could get in there if you wanted to.
So snoops are allowed at some point.
Oh yeah. It's not totally sealed off, but it's not really it's not really a museum you can just show up and wander around in.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's good.
All right, Bill, thanks a lot.
Sure thing. Happy to be here.
Hi, this is Peter Johnson, and I just wanted to take the opportunity to wish all of our listeners, as well as my wonderful co-hosts here on the Airplane Geeks, a very peaceful holiday break. And I look forward to bringing you more wonderful guests from this side of the pond in 2014.
And now here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian, with his Christmas message.
Thanks, Max. As you know, it's hard to believe, but this is my fourth Christmas with this team. Each year I've done something a little different, and this last year we had a lot of success with my story about the mysterious tanker and the B-47 flying to Japan. Tonight we're going to take a little different, a little more younger tact. This is the story of Susie the Christmas Cirrus. Once upon a time there was an R-22 by the name of Susie. She was sparkling white with a deep blue cheat line. Susie was very proud she had taught many people to fly. She had a great pilot by the name of Rob. All planes should have a pilot like Rob. He was very safe. He flew fast planes and big planes, but Susie was his favorite. Susie, though, was sad. She was fun to fly and she trained people. She didn't feel important. She just was a GA airplane. Around the airport, there were a lot of important airplanes. They were always coming and going to and from exotic places. I want to be like them, pined Susie. There was Peter, a jet stream. He was constantly taking special people to places, and he always talked with that suave European accent. He also always seemed to take priority. Mr. Ben in the tower always seemed to favor him. Everyone else had to hold and wait. The only other plane to get that treatment was that flashy G4 by the name of Binet. On the other side of the airfield lived Steve, a C-130E. Oh, the stories he could tell. He was a veteran of the basketball wars. He talked about flying in Australia with a damaged wing just to save some kangaroos. His main buddy on the airfield was Grant. When Grant was around, he was always filled with hot air. He was a hot air balloon, a real basket case. But this being December, Susie wasn't sure where he went when it was cold. Dan was a 757 and John was a 787. They went to really cool places like Paris for air shows and Seattle for Christmas. Where else would Boeing jets go for the holidays? Home. They took humans everywhere. Courtney, the regional jet, was running back and forth somewhere like a bus. Lastly, Austin, the Army UH-60, seemed to be hauling Christmas trees around the airfield. Susie just felt depressed. All she ever did was go around the pattern, up and down, around in circles. Some of the other airplanes teased poor Susie because all she did was circuits and bumps. While Pilot Rob was gentle with her, those other humans were rough. Susie longed to go far away. There was this place, Oshkosh, where airplanes went for summer vacation. Susie had heard of the place from a Beaver Bush plane from Maine, wherever that was. Susie sighed. Another place I'll never get to see. But Micah, and that was his name, he had told her about a place where he could land on both water and land. One day, a plane arrived to much ruckus. He made funny noises and had his propellers on backwards. He was strange indeed. He was a Hammerhead UAS, and his name was Max. Susan wasn't sure what to make of Max. He was the most strange airplane ever. The others around the airport said he was not to be trusted because he didn't fly with a human inside. Who was she to judge? Besides, there were days that all of her landing gear hurt from all those bumps, and Susie wished she could fly without people. Max, welcome to the airport. I'm Susie. I hope you enjoy your stay. Max was surprised. He was so used to be called drone and bad airplane. It was a really nice little gal, and she was friendly. So it was getting closer towards Christmas, and it being snowing, there wasn't going to be much flying. Susie decided to move into a hangar. She stared out the hangar doors, looking at the blue skies. She wanted to fly, even though it was cold. But then she started to daydream about that place called Oshkosh. It had a magical arrival called Fisk. You had airplanes to the left, airplanes to the right, humans in pink shirts telling you to land on colored dots. The airplanes there were the friendliest in the world. They even had a place for those silly airplanes without landing gear called Seaplane Base. For a whole week, humans and airplanes lived together in rain, heat, mud, and Kavu skies. It didn't matter. Everyone was happy. No matter if you were a jet or a little Piper Cub, you all flew together. Susie thought, I bet they would even let Max go next year. Then she woke up from the beautiful dream to the reality. All I do is bumps and circuits. I'll never get to go. I never leave the pattern. It was the day before Christmas and the skies were deep blue. I wish I could go flying today. Pilot Rob had put up a Christmas tree in the corner of the hangar. It blinked red and green and had all sorts of really little airplanes hanging from the branches. Susie stared at the tree and thought, and remembered. Pilot Rob talked about a human who flew, what was it? Oh yes, a sleigh. Rob told someone that human pilot granted wishes. He had a bright red flight suit with white fur collar. He had pictured the humans that came out of Ryan. Ryan was an old B-24 bomber who would come to the airport for weekends in the summer and tell stories to take people up for a ride. Susie thought, maybe he can make airplane wishes also. What was that human's name? Cessna Claus? Oh, that's right, Santa Claus. So she closed her cockpit and wished as hard as she could. Dear Santa, I know I'm only an airplane that goes around the pattern. I know you grant wishes to little humans, but I really want to go to Oshkosh. If there's a way, maybe I can go too? Thanks, Susie Cirrus. Nothing happened. Susie was sad. They closed the hangar doors because it started to snow. They turned off the lights. Yet Pilot Rob left the tree on. The lights blinked and the polished floor reflected their twinkle all through the hangar. It was a lot like the runway lights on a pretty night. Susie felt at peace and drifted off to sleep. The next morning was Christmas Day. The sun was shining all over the runways were plowed. Pilot Rob threw open the doors and patted Susie's cowl. Good morning, old friend. We have a special flight today. Susie was pushed out onto the apron. There were people waiting outside, all in coats, standing in the cold. One of the humans had landing gear. That was strange. Pilot Rob pushed the human from behind, just like he would push Susie out of the hangar. Pilot Bob then said, "Susie, this is Brandon. He's getting his wish from Santa today. We're going to take him up in the pattern. Brandon, say hi to Susie." Brandon lightly touched Susie's cowl and said, softly, "Hi, Susie." Pilot Rob put him in the student seat and fastened him in tight. His feet didn't touch the pedals. He closed the door and Susie started to move towards the runway. Pilot Rob used a different call sign. "Christmas Wish 1, ready for takeoff." "You're cleared on runway 25, Christmas Wish 1, called Mr. Ben from the tower. "Merry Christmas, Brandon." "Christmas Wish 1, rolling 25. Down the runway Susie went like she did 100 times before, but this time was different. Brandon cheered as Susie went up into the cold sky. There was a huge surge of warmth from the cockpit. Brandon wouldn't stop saying, "Look at that! Look over there!" Pilot Rob flew Susie gently around the circuit. Susie never noticed how pretty things were in the pattern before. Brandon kept pointing at things and Susie would look. Snow and trees, lights and snowmen. She then realized there was so much to see. She then realized how much fun it was just to fly, even if it was just in the pattern. Today she was flying with the Angels. Brandon was such a special co-pilot. After an hour or so, Pilot Bob landed Susie and taxied back to the hangar where all the humans were applauding. Pilot Bob took Brandon out of the airplane and put him back in his landing gear. Brandon quickly spun towards Susie and said, "Thank you and Merry Christmas," and rushed over to the other humans and started telling them all about what he saw in the pattern. Pilot Rob pushed Susie back in the hangar. "Well done, girl. That was the most important flight you have ever flown." That night, back in the hangar, Susie was very happy. She learned that being in the pattern could have joy. In the hangar that night was a guest, a blue and old yellow steerman that seemed to have a lot of history. "Hello, my name is David." Susie said, "Hello." The steerman said, "I trained a lot of people like you do, Susie. I still love doing the pattern. I just don't do it as much now. But Susie, I have a message from the North Pole for you. Santa sent me to tell you that you are an excellent airplane. You were very kind to Max when no one else was. You also gave the gift of flight to someone who can't normally walk. Santa is very proud of you." A little fluid leaked from Susie's cowl. "Thank you and Merry Christmas. I finally feel like a special plane." The next morning, the steerman was gone. Susie should have heard him taxi out. That was strange. Just then, the doors flew open and Pilot Rob was grinning ear to ear. "Susie, oh girl, I just heard. I need to go away on business to Wisconsin. I got a job at Whitman Airport. You and I are going to Oshkosh." Susie leaked just a little more fluid. By being a good plane in the pattern, she got her Christmas wish. She was going to Oshkosh. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year's, and thank you all for being in our pattern every week. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Wow. That was something really special, David.
Nicely done, David. It really was. I love the, there's always that little magical twist to your stories at Christmas time. I've noticed that.
Gotta love Christmas.
Very good, David. Very good. Wow. I'm going to have to listen to that. I had that on mute, and I'm glad I did, because I was really laughing for an awful lot of that, David. So, well done. Very good. Thank you.
Hi, this is Hannes Arch, Red Bull Airways pilot and world champion 2008. I'm here with my technician just preparing my airplane for next season. So I wish you guys happy holidays and hope to see you at one of the races, especially in Dallas or in Las Vegas. Would be nice.
All right, let's move on now to the Australia Desk with Steve and Grant.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, December 16th, 2013.
Well, good day, folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 279. And Grant, I've got to say, that's another classic opening to the segment by you, mate, a classic one.
Oh, mate, based on a bit of a legacy system, but it still keeps working.
Okay, do you want to fry the historian or shall I?
Oh, I'm going to let you do that because I'll probably get in too much trouble if I do.
Well, you know, Grant, yes, the Hornet is an American design, but not many of Australia's Hornets were actually built in the US.
No, I think only about four of them. Two were built and flown over, two were built and tested and then disassembled and reassembled back in Australia, and all the rest were built here in Australia.
So there you go, and of course they were built at the government aircraft factory right here in Melbourne, so that means, of course, Grant, that they were delivered very late and well over budget.
Yes, well, there is always that bit, but mate, I'm sitting here on boeing.com.au's webpage, and yeah, they talk about their products, and they include the Super Hornet and the Classic Hornet.
Yes. And there you go, Grant. And I'll tell you another reason why our Hornets are better than the American ones. Actually, I'll give you two reasons. First, of course, is that they're all right-hand drive. And second, they're all metric.
Wow, that's pretty good reasons. But also, don't forget, Government Aircraft Factory, mate, along with McDonnell Douglas Management, Government Aircraft Factory managed to reverse infiltrate Boeing and contributed to the demise of the development projects of many of their aircraft. But anyhow, that's a whole different thing. Australia subversion through buyouts.
You're right. You're never going to let that one go, mate, are you?
No, never. I enjoy that too much.
Okay, mate, let's talk about something completely different this week. Let's talk about an Australian airline in trouble.
Oh, not Qantas again. Haven't we done that to death?
No. It appears, Grant, that there is actually more than Qantas in trouble at the moment. In fact, regional airline Brindabella Airlines, as we record this in today's news, they have been actually grounded. They've been put into receivership. They're going bankrupt. Not good. Yeah,
they could be leading Qantas down the garden path. We don't really know. But yes, Brindabella Airlines, based in Canberra, a New South Wales regional airline. They have had some problems with some of their Jetstream 41s being grounded. They were behind on doing maintenance by sometimes up to a year on some of the engine maintenance, apparently, if I read some of the articles correctly. And CASA grounded a few of their aircraft. They managed to get a couple of them back in the air. And then CASA turned around and said, actually, it's worse. Ground a lot of you. And with all those aircraft out, they just had nothing to do but to turn around and say, right, we're bringing in the receivers. And shock, horror, the receivers are Quarter Mentha, yes, a company that many in the Australian aviation scene will know because they were the receivers for Ansett.
They were indeed, Grant, although I will say Quarter Mentha did a very, very solid job of trying to get Ansett back in the air. And unfortunately, that wasn't able to happen more than for a couple of days. I think they got it flying and then it went down again forever. But yeah, it's a sad thing that Brindabella is going. We don't talk about the regional operators here very often. Most often, of course, I guess, Grant, we talk about Rex or Regional Express. Brindabella, they do some vital work out to the more regional centres around the New South Wales area. In fact, they even make their way as far north as Brisbane up in Queensland. And it's a real shame. The regional sector here has been screaming out for help for a long time. They've been under a lot of pressure. They've been doing their best to lobby the government, the previous government and the new one, I would assume. And it doesn't look like they're having a lot of luck with that because Brindabella is obviously under a lot of financial strain, which is leading to things as you talked about there, Grant, where maintenance is starting to go down the gurgler, and it's never, never a good thing. And CASA obviously was left with no alternative but to ground some of their aircraft.
That's the one, mate. And I find it quite interesting, Quarter Mentha. It's deja vu all over again because Ansett had similar problems, regulation, maintenance. The straw that broke the camel's back for Ansett was the grounding of their 767s due to being out of maintenance and not complying with a number of issues. And here we have the same kind of thing happening with Brindabella on a much smaller scale with their jet streams and so on. So very, very interesting it's going on. I mean, the receivers are saying, oh, it's all due to regulation and maintenance and competition, which is rather interesting because a number of Brindabella's routes are monopoly subsidized by the New South Wales government. So yeah, very interesting, very tragic, especially for those with flights booked. Qantas is trying to step in and help out with some good deals. Note, not free flights, but good deals for those who were trying to fly on Brindabella and had confirmed bookings with them. So we'll see where this goes. The CEO of Rex is saying that he thinks more regional regionals are likely to fold. We'll see if that comes true. But with a lot of things going on, the mining boom is starting to soften here in Australia. It's been the case for the last year or so. It's been softening, but that's starting to pull some cash out of the economy. Holden is shutting down and no longer assembling cars here in Australia. So that's going to have flow-ons. There's all sorts of things going on. And now this, I think Australia could be just about to feel the bite of the GFC at last. I mean, we managed to avoid it for a few years, but I think we're about to get it.
Mm, yeah, well, it's certainly not good news in many, many, not only aviation, but as you mentioned, Grant, in the manufacturing industry. Very bad timing, not only for the passengers who might have booked with Brindabella, but they also employ 140 staff. So very bad. Bad news, and we wish all of those people the very best for Christmas, and let's hope that they can get that airline sorted out financially. Maybe some sort of financial backer will come in and sort that out, and hopefully those people can keep their jobs. That would be a wonderful thing.
Especially this close to Christmas.
Absolutely. Now let's move on to some military news. Now in the news this evening on the 6 o'clock news, I notice in fact some good news for Australia's Defence Force as the last of Australia's troops are leaving Afghanistan, flying out in a Royal Australian Air Force C-17 and heading home, which is fantastic, but not all Australian personnel are leaving, it seems. This article here in australianaviation.com.au says that the Heron remote piloted vehicles will be staying on around the Afghanistan region, and the Air Force will be operating them for quite some time to come.
They've been a big success. We've interviewed the folks behind the Heron at Avalon a couple of years ago, and this year, major success for the RAF. It's been a big project. They've done a lot of trials in the Woomera area in South Australia, and they've rolled a lot of what they've learnt from Afghanistan into the trials and training there, and then taking what they've learned from there back to Afghanistan. And yeah, they're doing such a good job. They're being kept over there. You start to wonder, hang on, maybe I should have done a bad job. I could be coming home, you know?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. Yeah, so that's interesting. And the thing I find interesting about the Heron is it's, in terms of its engine and power plant, it's just a, you know, a piston pounder. It's a Rotax engine, I think. It's, you know, no high-tech turbine engine in those things. I find that quite interesting. And as you say, Grant, a very, very reliable machine.
Yeah, well, it does its job. It's out there. It's doing intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance. It's giving them eyes beyond the horizon and all those kind of tasks that drones are absolutely perfect for. And it's also not armed. So it's not out there launching weapons or anything. It's just gathering the info and pointing people where they need to go.
Another piece of Australian military hardware that in fact is armed, and certainly be plenty of them when they come, are the MH-60 Romeo helicopters. And it looks like, Grant, the first one has been officially accepted by the Royal Australian Navy over there in the United States.
That's right, mate. People over here going, Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo? Oh, well, that would be because it's at Lockheed Martin's Owego, New York facility, where they were just recently handed over the first two. And yes, I'm sorry if I've totally butchered that name.
Yes, and of course, for the AVGeeks amongst you, these are serial numbers N48-001 and 002. Grant, and I've got to say, they look pretty snazzy with the Royal Australian Navy roundels on there.
Yeah, I know. They're pretty cool. I'm looking forward to having these arrive. It wasn't just a couple of weeks ago, I think, that they started groundbreaking on the dedicated hangars and facilities for the Romeos at Nowra in New South Wales, the main Navy base where they park a lot of their aircraft when they're not out on the ships. And yeah, we're looking forward to seeing how this all comes together. We did a great interview with the MH-60R crew a couple of Avalons back. That's on our video feed. And definitely looking forward to getting these babies in a real service. I'm sure they're not going to look quite as sexy as the ones in this photo with all the blue lighting. But hey, you know, we'll take them.
Absolutely. And of course, the Royal Australian Navy will be taking on 24 of these helicopters. 24, Grant, can you imagine it? The awesome might of our Defence Force. And that means we'll have just as many Romeos helicopters as we do Super Hornets.
Yeah, mate, we're going to be huge. Awesome. 24 plus the six C-17s. We're going to add up to about, don't say it.
It could be one squadron of US Air Force.
Yeah, I know. Thank you, David. We can hear you saying it and laughing already. Oh, dear.
Well, that's everything we have for you this year, in fact, on the Australia Desk. This is the last segment for 2013. We want to thank all of you for listening this year. And just on a personal note, I'd like to thank those of you who've taken the time to email me this week with all your good wishes for my recent injury with my knee. I really do appreciate that, folks. Grant, I've had quite a few Facebook messages and emails. It's been very nice of everybody. So there you go. Another big year down, and looking forward to 2014.
Yeah, can it only please improve from here on up? Yay. You know, your knee gets better. My shoulder gets better. Our income gets better. It could only be up.
Yeah. Well, I take income. Oh, you know. No, actually, I'd like my knee to work again, but there you go.
Yeah,
well,
I'm looking for all of the above, mate.
From both of us, we'd like to wish everybody who listens to the show a very safe and prosperous new year, and of course, a very Merry Christmas. And Grant, I guess we'll talk to everybody next year.
Yeah, that's right, mate, because, you know, it's the summer holidays down here, so we're going to be spending our Christmas on the beach. Ho, 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 it's Sandy Christmas.
Sounds good to me. Until next year, I'm Steve Bisher.
And I'm Grant Sandy Claus McCarran.
Merry Christmas, folks.
Sandy Claus?
That's pretty good, huh?
Oh, my Lord. There's just something wrong about spending Christmas on a beach, isn't there?
Yeah.
Well, you know, they sent me gift tags that showed Ruse on a Barbie. I mean, Ruse using a Barbie.
So they built those F-18s in Australia?
They did.
Are F-18s built in other countries as well?
No. Australia, I believe, is the only one that actually built them.
Yeah.
But they did not build their Super Hornets. So,
okay.
They built their Legacy Hornets. Oh, I'm sorry, class, not Legacy. They're naval aircraft. I'll use the Navy term. So I guess we should say thank you for all their hard work this year.
Why would we do that? Oh, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, those guys really put in a lot. It's amazing. It's very amazing.
Well, I think Grant has just done a great job kind of, you know, holding down the fort with Steve, you know, spending so much time on the couch, you know, watching TV and stuff. I mean,
is that what he's doing, watching TV?
Oh, yeah.
See, Rob, and you wonder why I get a care package from Australia and you don't.
Yeah.
Yeah, and for those of you that haven't been up on, was that on our Facebook page? I didn't even notice, actually.
No, it was on my Facebook
page. Oh, okay. I mean, the Tim Tam booties were just, they were just great. I mean, I didn't even know they made Tim Tam booties.
I didn't either.
And maybe a better question is,
Why would you make? Yeah.
Hello, that's Raymond Friedman. I'm the chief pilot of the Flying Bulls at Salzburg. And I wish all the airplane geeks a very nice Christmas.
All right, here's Peter Johnson across the pond.
We welcome back Osama Saleh from the Osama's Take blog to talk Middle East and North Africa. Osama, welcome back across the pond.
Thanks, Peter. It's nice to be back.
Delighted to have you back. Very popular guest last time round. Got some really positive feedback. Since we last talked, there's been the Dubai Air Show and the opening of the new airport, of course, in Dubai. Let's start with the air show orders. Emirates, Qatar, Kuwait, all putting in large orders. Are these airlines looking to international growth? Is this fleet replacement or simply capacity building?
Well, it's a little of both.
Right.
I mean, Emirates, even with the A380, they indicated that some of the newer A380s will replace some of their earlier ones. The same thing with Etihad. They actually bought some of the aircraft that they will actually use with Air Berlin and Air Serbia.
Right.
The Kuwaitis, with their latest Airbus order, they are talking of replacing 17 of their existing fleet, which is more than 18 years old, and so on. So it's a bit of both. Of course, the three Gulf airlines, the big ones, which is Emirates, Etihad, and Qatar, are of course looking for growth. They're looking for more flights into the United States, more yeah. flights into Latin America, and of course Australia. They're Emirates is looking at Fifth Freedom authorities, but not at this time. Probably in a year or two, they will start looking at doing flights between Europe and the States and things like this. They've already done one Milan to New York,
yeah.
And this is being it's a mixed thing. It's an experiment for them, and they're trying to see how it will go. But expansion is on the books.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, people are accusing Boeing of tailoring the aircraft, the 777X, to the Gulf carriers.
Yeah, well, it was Lufthansa who placed the original order, though, wasn't it? It wasn't actually Emirates who placed the first order or Etihad.
No, it was Lufthansa, actually, that placed the first order. And Boeing is saying that what they did was they actually tailored the aircraft to what not only Emirates, Etihad, and Qatar wanted, but also to what Lufthansa needed.
Yeah.
Because everybody said the airplane reaches longer than most European or North American carriers would like to be. And Boeing says, no, Lufthansa likes the airplane, therefore that should be good enough for the other legacy carriers.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of expansion coming up in the coming few years. And of course, Dubai won the rights for the 2020 Expo.
Yeah.
So that is also going to mean a large expansion for at least Emirates. And I'm sure Etihad will probably get some of the business that's coming to Dubai and probably Qatar Airways. So exciting times.
And one of the ways that they seem to be expanding in the Middle East, Etihad particular, has bought a 49% stake in Serbia, we heard last week, and also a 33% equity stake in Darwin Airlines. What's their strategy here?
Well, they don't want to join an alliance, which Qatar Airways did, that joined One World. So their idea is, you need feed from Europe and Australia to their hub in Abu Dhabi.
Right.
The easiest way to do is buy an existing airline. And they did that with Air Berlin, with Virgin Australia, Aer Lingus, Air Seychelles, Jet Airways in India. And it seems to be working for them. Now, with Air Serbia, they're actually replacing the fleet. Etihad will actually give Air Serbia A319s that they have on order.
Yeah.
So part of the Etihad order will go to Air Serbia. And of course, for them, Air Serbia will give them a Central European hub that will feed into the UAE. And definitely, there are a lot of people from CIS and Central Europe that are working in the UAE and in the region. Now, the more exciting one, which is different, is the Darwin Airlines, which will be branded Etihad Regional.
Right.
And I think by June, they will add something like about maybe 16 additional routes, which will feed into Etihad's European stations like Paris, Amsterdam, and Geneva, Zurich, and a few more. And the idea is to actually bring traffic from secondary airports to feed into Etihad and Etihad's partner airline. And now, that to me is an interesting development.
Yeah.
Which is, so far, nobody in Europe has complained loudly. So, but I'm sure after the holidays,
it won't be long. It won't be long.
Yeah.
But Emirates and Etihad are not the only airlines expanding. We also mentioned Qatar, of course, as well. Libya have ordered 10 Airbus A350s, and Kuwait's also put in a $4 billion Airbus order. Can the region take this much expansion?
Well, it's not Libyan Arab Airlines. It's a new airline. It's an airline startup that is starting, and they ordered 10 A350s.
Yeah.
Now, of course, Libya is a big country. It's an OPEC country. It has money. It has wealth. Provided they can manage to unify the country and stabilize the government there, there's always potential for expansion. It's big business. But I don't think we'll be seeing the A350s there for another 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
Is there expansion? Of course. I mean, Libya is underserved. I mean, Libyan Arab Airlines has been decimated, and that's not a very large airline, and it's probably not the most preferred airline out of Benghazi or Tripoli.
Yeah.
Now, Kuwait finally put in the order.
And the order is for, I think, 15 A320neos and 10 A350-900s with a few, with another, I think, 10 aircraft to be leased by the middle of 2014. But Kuwait primarily is a fleet renewal. I mean, half of the stuff they're buying is to actually renew the fleet.
Yeah, it's quite an old fleet, actually, isn't it?
Yes, and the airline is being privatized. It's they're having problems privatizing the aircraft, the airline. They're not sure how to privatize the airline, but they have labor problems. They have internal political problems with the privatization. So, is there expansion? Of course, there would be expansion. I mean, it's also an oil country. It's a rich country. It's popular. It's not as popular as a tourist destination like Dubai or Abu Dhabi or even Doha.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that it couldn't be.
Unfortunately, that was all we had time for on this segment. But as last time, Osama and I continue to talk and we'll bring you the rest of that discussion after Christmas. This is Peter Johnson reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Great stuff. Thanks, Peter. You know, we should thank Peter also for putting in all the hard work he does to bring us the Across the Pond segment each week. It's these things are a lot of work, as we've said. Peter continues to get out there and find some great guests to have some good conversations with. So we want to thank Peter for all that.
And let's face it, he covers the rest of the world that we and the Plane Crazy Down Under guys don't.
Yeah, but look how much more work the Australia guys have to go through. I mean, their stuff is so much further away.
it takes more time.
It takes longer. I mean, it does.
I guess.
And from Scott Spangler and myself here at JetWine in Chicago, we'd like to wish all of our JetWine and Airplane Geeks listeners and readers all over the world Merry Christmas, and we can't wait to hear from all of you in 2014.
All right, let's blast through some of the listener mail that we have. As is often the case, we can only touch on a small portion of all of it. We do have some listener recordings, some longer ones, and some longer emails that I think we'll again have to defer. But a couple of sort of quicker ones. I'm looking at some of the links that folks have sent in, starting off with Cal. Now, he sent us a link that's titled Airplane Almost Blown Sideways During Landing Attempt, and this comes from ABC News. This shows an Emirates 777 that's attempting a crosswind landing at Birmingham Airport, which I think he eventually sort of goes off and decides he's not going to be able to do that. But I don't know if you guys saw this video, but the newscasters play this like, you know, this was almost a near-death experience, that this is sort of the worst thing anybody's ever seen. And when I look at this looks like a kind of a standard, fairly high crosswind landing, but, you know, it's the usual kind of crab approach. I don't know. Did you take a look at this, Rob?
Yeah, I did, actually, and there's another one that was going along with it of a Dash 8 turboprop trying to make an approach into Birmingham the same day. That was all part of that big storm that hit the UK last week, and I agree. I mean, I thought the best part was that maybe they got within about 30 feet of the ground, and the flying pilot said, "Nope, this ain't gonna work," and they went around. Now, if they'd been trying to touch down and straighten the airplane out and it had gotten wobbly, then I'd have thought, yeah, that might have been closer to a near-death experience. But I didn't see any big deal with it. My guess is that the last 10 or 15 seconds down final, as they're sitting sideways in the cockpit, one person's looking at the other saying, this ain't going to work.
I don't know. I just thought it was... I thought the reporting was kind of irresponsible.
I did too. I thought it was all overblown.
It really was. But we'll put the link to that in the show notes. Another link, David Montgomery sent us an article from Forbes, an inside look, United Airlines Mission Control Center, which is a great follow-up, as he mentioned, to our episode on flight dispatching. And it turns out that, you know, kind of coincident with that, there was this this report of the United Mission Control Center. It's very interesting and kind of gives you the visual of some of the stuff that we talked about. So thanks, David, for sending that in. Another video, and we had, I don't know how many listeners send this one to us. This might be a record for a number of listeners that send us a link to this one video. And this, of course, is the WestJet Christmas Miracle video, which last I checked had, I don't know, north of 22,000 or rather million downloads, very popular. Did you guys have a chance to take a look at this one? I think almost everyone has by now.
I was going to say, how could you not? It's been on every WestJet. Congratulations, you have gotten the single best publicity ever. You got to admit though, it's really cool. I my personal favorite out of it is the guy who was being a smartass and said all he wanted was underwear and socks,
and that's what he got.
And that's what he got was underwear and socks. So. It's definitely a must-watch.
It is, and I think it's brilliant. Good for WestJet for the idea and for pulling this off. Dan sent us a link to an in-flight movie out an airplane window. And I'm thinking, all right, well, this is going to be, I don't know, scenery or something like that. Well, it's a time-lapse of the Aurora. At altitude from the airplane. And I thought this was probably some of the most amazing Aurora Borealis video I have ever seen. It's really very interesting. And, of course, time-lapse, because this thing changes fairly slowly. If you've ever had an opportunity to see the Aurora, you don't get to watch generally, to watch the thing moving around a lot. You need sort of a time-lapse approach. So I thought this video was really impressive.
I enjoyed that. I really, really did. And I'm just, you know, I like the fact that our listeners take the time to share that with us so that we can share it with the rest of the people. I mean, because none of us would probably, well, a whole lot of people wouldn't be able to see anything like that ever.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, this is beautiful, really gorgeous.
Can I just say just, adds to my IFE theory.
That's right. The best show in the house, David, is?
Out the window.
Out the window. Very good. Micah sent us an article, U.S. fighter plane that survived Pearl Harbor will take flight again. And this is a, let's see, now I've forgotten. David, what aircraft
Curtis, is it? It is a Curtis P-40B Warhawk.
Right. And this was in Europe, as I recall.
It was in Great Britain, and it actually is a Pearl Harbor survivor. Ironically, it was down for maintenance and in the hangar and wasn't blown up on the apron like the rest of them, and was eventually restored with a couple of other things and then sent to London. And it Collings Foundation, who owns the B-17, 909, and the B-24, as well as the P-51 and a bunch of other aircraft, are bringing it home to fly it across the country. So well done, Collings Foundation, for bringing home a piece of history.
Yeah, yeah. It's very cool. And let's see. Harry sent us, the guys at Just the Flight, which is a UK travel booking site, they put together something called the Evolution of the Airline Cabin, which is kind of an interesting sort of multimedia kind of thing that takes you through the timeline of what was going on in the airline cabin over the years. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Another one from Cal, how a MiG-31 repelled the world's fastest spy plane from Soviet skies. This is about the MiG-31 and how it, well, I don't know, David, how able was it to sort of pressure the SR-71 back in the day?
It was the Foxbat was the MiG-25. It grew into the MiG-31, which was a more powerful version, and the MiG-25 was designed to counteract the XB-70, and so it was a follow-on aircraft, and yeah, it definitely was catching up to the SR-71 if it wasn't for the stealth of the SR-71, which most people didn't realize it had. Might have actually at some point shot one down, so it's interesting the way to look at it that way.
And David Cenciotti contributed to this article that's originally from The Aviationist, and so we'll put a link to that in the show notes. And then finally, a link from a story from Michael Braun, FA-18 Hornet marks 35 years of flight. This is for a Navy piece on that. 35 years. Boy, you know, these things, these airplanes, David, they last a long time.
Well, I don't know how many F-18As are still flying around, the Canadians and the Australians, but 35 years, well, I was dumbfounded when this year marks the 35th year the Thunderbirds have been flying F-16s. So it's definitely, I don't know where the time went. These were new airplanes when I was a little kid, and why are they being retired now? That means something happened, and I don't know what it was.
Right. All right, well, I think that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. I want to thank everyone for listening. We want to thank our guest, Bill English, from the NTSB Office of Aviation Safety. He's an investigator in charge, and as we've been going through the rest of the show, he's been sending us lots of links to items from the NTSB site on the Asiana docket and some other things, too. And, Bill, are you still there?
You sure am.
Well, thank you so much for giving us all that information. It's been just really wonderful, and I know of no other way that we could have learned as much about the NTSB and how the investigations operate than having you come on the show. So we really, really want to thank you.
Well, happy to be here. You know, this has got to be one of the most educational podcasts there is. I learn a lot from you guys, too.
Great. Thanks. We keep trying, and Bill did send along a lot of photos and other information, and we'll have all that on the website, airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 279, so if you're listening to this some point in the future and want to get to it easily, the shortcut is airplanegeeks.com/279. As always, we want to thank our contributors, Steve Isher and Grant McHaren, the Wounded Australians from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. Also, Peter Johnson. Find his podcast at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. All right, time to tell folks where they can find us online. David Vanderhoof, we will start with you.
You can find me on NORAD Track Santa, at least the next couple of days.
Yeah.
NORADTrackSanta.com. But you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on my blog, What Just Flew By, and of course, our various social media pages, airplanegeeks.com.
And Rob Mark, what are just some of the places that people can find you?
Well, certainly here in Chicago, I'll be out on the beach tomorrow because it's a big, you know, up in the
playing in the sand, right?
It appears like it's going to be.
He'll
about
be Santa Claus.
Yeah, it's Frozen Claws. No, seriously, jetwine.com, which is our blog, certainly. And I just have to say it's really nice. We passed a birthday. I mean, we're in our seventh year now. And, oh, gosh, wow. It just seems like it was yesterday. But certainly Jetwine on Twitter my name in various forms on Facebook. And who knows where else we show up. That is legal, I think. Anyway, all over the place.
All right. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Google Plus and Twitter as Max Flight. Also at the UAVDigest.com, little project Dave and I have. Also, something new, and just sort of generally, RunwayGirlNetwork.com. This is Mary Kirby's new project. If you haven't seen this site yet, go take a look. A lot of good information there. I don't think I've ever seen something this comprehensive out of the box. And in fact, part of this is a podcast, a passenger experience podcast, something that I'm working with Mary on, and we've actually had our first episode. So you can find all that at runwaygirlnetwork.com. As I mentioned, you can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 279. Be sure to follow us on all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, Google+, also Stitcher.com and TuneIn.com. If you'd like to send us an email, we have an address. That's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And of course, we have a listener line. You can leave an audio message there. Bene Wilson, the aviation queen, will tell you about that.
The Airplane Geeks want to hear from you, so please give them a call at 361-GEEK-01.
Thank you, Bene. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Now, join us again, well, I think in 2 weeks. Next week is Christmas week, and we should be taking that off. So we'll look for, let's see, we'll actually record on the 30th, but it'll publish the 1st, January 1st. So this is the last episode for 2013. I want to thank all of our listeners for putting up with us, and you, Rob, and you, David, for putting up with me. And I think that'll do.
Just say all the listeners are putting up with David Knight.
No.
Which actually, there's probably some truth in that.
There is.
Absolutely.
All right. That's it. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening. Happy New Year.
Bye.
Merry Christmas.